Hello, I'm Stephen McInerney. Welcome to the Ramsey Podcast. In 2015, Rachel Fulton Brown, an award-winning professor of medieval history at the University of Chicago, rocketed to fame when she became embroiled in a culture war. Daring to challenge the narrative orthodoxy sweeping humanities departments, which presents white men as the embodiment of all that is mad, bad, and dangerous in the world, Professor Brown endeavoured to restore some balance to the discussion, pointing out that, among other things, white men created marriage laws that emphasised the importance of mutual consent in marriage, that they extended the vote to women, offered them employment, and supported their education. But contrary to what her critics might wish to believe, Professor Fulton Brown does not attribute these historical achievements to the superficialities of race or skin colour. Grace, and not race, is the focus of her research, and the real explanation, she believes, for these and other historical achievements. Fulton Brown is a Christian who embraces St. Paul's teaching that in Christ there is neither Greek or Jew, male or female. Professor Fulton Brown is in Sydney as a guest of the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, where she's delivering a lecture on great books of the Middle Ages and how to read them. And I'm delighted to be joined by her on the Ramsey Podcast. Rachel, welcome to Sydney.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. What were the Middle Ages?
Well, the title is actually a slur. It's like saying, what were the deplorables?
Right.
And it's a description of the period between, say, the conversion of Constantine and the Renaissance or the Reformation. And it's used in the modern period to describe those dark ages during which Christianity was uppermost. So what were the Middle Ages? They were the period in which Europe developed as a Christian civilization. They're also the period in which Europe developed its different nations, right, following the fall of the Roman Empire. So it's to describe it as deplorable is probably accurate in today's political climate.
Far from being backward, you've actually presented the idea that the Middle Ages are really central to the understanding of Western civilization, and even more than that, to the success of Western civilization. And in his book Middle Ages: Why the Battle for Medieval Studies Matters to America, your friend Milo Yiannopoulos quotes you, and in this passage you say, "This is why the West is so weak right now, because it cannot defend itself, its own tradition, without the Middle Ages. Even those who want to defend the West start with the Enlightenment, with reason and logic. But the Enlightenment, without its creative, religious, or artistic past, cannot defend itself. Our artistic tradition is focused on worship. Our artistic, musical, and dramatic traditions are all groundless without an understanding that they were created in order to worship God within the Christian church, standing before the throne of God and singing, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty.'" Can you talk a little bit more about that and the centrality, I suppose, of the worship of God in the formation of European culture?
I think I said it better then.
Right.
Obviously, one of the great challenges for Christianity is thinking about what it meant for God to become incarnate, the Word to become flesh. And so just unpacking what I said there in Middle Ages, if you want to understand the way our educational system developed, you have to understand that reverence for the spoken word, for spoken language, for logic, for rhetoric, for the trivium, grammar, rhetoric, and logic, and the training in human speech, always with the appreciation that it, you know, describing God is beyond our capacity, right? So when in the Enlightenment, I think they set up reason as this end, and with the confidence that through reason we can solve all problems, that is prideful, hubristic in so many ways, because you're saying you with the limitations of human language can describe even the transcendent. In the Middle Ages, the universities grew up with an expectation that there's always something beyond our capacity to think, to describe, and it's curious that having that transcendent referent means that you, in fact, say more about our human experience than you do when you think that we can encompass it all just with our own capacities.
So reason is simultaneously elevated and put in its place.
Yes.
By reference to the transcendent.
Yes, because in Christian terms, we understand ourselves as made in the image and likeness of God, and that image and likeness includes being made in the image and likeness of the Word who became flesh. So, you know, that God is Logos, and the Logos is with God, you recognize that our ability to speak has that divine referent. But on the other hand, the Word has to become flesh, because otherwise we can't access the fullness of understanding of the divinity. So we are both reflections of God and obviously not God. And that tension between our elevation as creatures and our proper place in recognizing ourselves as creatures is what I see as the driving creative force behind medieval civilization.
And you mentioned the Enlightenment's, you know, celebration of reason at the expense of, you know, that which is essentially of faith. Is there also something in the Enlightenment and since which emphasizes the need for detachment and objectivity over, say, engagement and immersion in the subject? And how has that affected the way we view, for example, education?
Well, I mean, the modern position is one of the material, right? And so objectivity is, I think, always a bit of a red herring, because the claim that we can be objective is more grounded in this sense of we are objective insofar as we deny any spiritual reality, which, as you know, modern New Age religions constantly prove, people are not terrifically convinced that we are only material, and that you ask to say what do we do with that in educational terms? Well, one, I suggest in the talk that I'm giving this afternoon, it leaves us with a great sorrow in our own engagement with even the productions of human creativity, because you're always doing it towards what in Christian terms is essentially an idol, right? Something that is not live, not the living God, but just a human creation. And it's interesting that when we focus solely on ourselves, it's dead. It's lifeless. Whereas when we focus on God, we receive life. So that blind faith stereotype or caricature is always, you can tell in people's insults what they're actually just, you know, hiding. And faith is what enables you to see the reality of our existence as creatures, and therefore the joy of being able to say thank you to God for being the creatures that we are. And I'd say in education, if we don't have some sense of that joy, then, you know, it turns into what people often criticize in American academia. It's like we're just getting pieces of paper and credentials so that you can go off and have a career, which is soul destroying.
So in fact, it's more important than, you know, the example one might pick would be if you're reading a poem or looking at a painting. It's more important in the sense to be moved by it, to respond to it holistically, rather than in a sense to analyze it. That analysis is something that should be subordinate to the original experience. Is that?
Not quite.
Okay.
Right, because I think one of the things clearly missing in modern education is an appreciation of aesthetics. And you can be affected by something and not know why you're affected by it. And so analysis, properly speaking, should give you a greater appreciation, right? So that you, if you enjoy opera, you can enjoy it just because it sounds grand and magnificent, or you can enjoy it because you're able to hear the different instruments working together and hear the different voices and understand the way the music is playing against the characters and so forth. So analysis should give you that richness, right? Or like if you know, you're enjoy a particular food, to be able to describe the flavors and think about how they interact together. That we should be doing with text as well. You should be seeing the way the language is used. You should be seeing the rhetorical moves it makes, appreciate the imagery that it draws on, and the argument. So, in fact, the trivium, right? Grammar, rhetoric, and logic, that you have the more you're able to appreciate it structurally, it should intensify your experience of it.
So St. Anselm's idea of theology being faith seeking understanding has its analog, I suppose, in aesthetics, you know, beauty seeking understanding or seeking to understand beauty
right.
and how it works on us. And so it's not in that sense, analysis is not in opposition to the experience. But is there a problem nonetheless if students are brought to the stage of analysis before they actually have the aesthetic experience itself? In other words, if they're taught to analyze a passage in a text or a musical structure before they've actually had that encounter with beauty,
mm-hmm.
can that actually harm the experience or get in the way of the experience?
Well, so I teach at the college level, so I'm teaching people who are fairly grown up. They're 18 or older. And the course that I teach that's specific to this question is my course on The Lord of the Rings on Tolkien. And I have a prerequisite for that course that says they have to have read the book before they take the class. And for some of them, that's a book that they've read many times before in their growing up. For others, they have to read it during spring break so that they could take the class. And one of the things the students have regularly said to me is they're worried that the exercise of analysis will destroy their pleasure in the text. And they've regularly told me they're very grateful for the fact that it hasn't, right? And so that I think there's analysis in their analysis. And what they're worried about is my taking it apart and showing them how it's a corrupted text, or, you know, that it's somehow misleading them, or it's sexist or racist, the usual. And what I'm trying to show them is Tolkien's artistry, the framing that he creates for the stories, the way he thinks about history, the way he thought about language, so that when they go back and reread it again, the pleasure is intensified, right? That they're noticed, that you're training to be able to see, or, you know, my metaphor here, the faith is what teaches you to see more than you would have without that attention.
So this is criticism and analysis as an aid to understanding rather than, say, critique with the aim of dismissing something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that seems to me to be a fundamental, a fundamentally different response to the common one now in especially in humanities departments, which seems to be that masterpieces are set up so as to be debunked
right.
and dismissed as basically nothing other than operations of power and oppression. And naturally, students over time find that exhausting. If everything is just being set up to be debunked, then why study them at all? Why read them at all?
Exactly. They hate that.
Yeah.
And we have a perennial conversation in American academia about how, you know, enrollments in the humanities are falling. It's like, well, consider why.
Yeah.
That you have in college a population of students who likes reading, right? They come to, say, a class in English and want to read texts that they have enjoyed reading previously, and then they are taught to hate them. And there's a colleague of mine at Chicago, Lisa Ruddock, who has in fact done a full study of the effects on graduate students in English, you know, on their soul, right? And saying it's what they're in, the process of training them to be professional critics is in fact debilitating and soul destroying.
Well, it's enervating, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
It just saps you of all energy and interest, not only in the subjects, but beyond that, as you've said, it's soul-destroying, beyond that interest in life, in the world.
Yes.
And you've talked about the importance of joy in education and beyond education. Could you explore that for us a bit more? What role does joy have?
Well, joy is what the incarnation brings,
yeah.
right? And that's, in The Lord of the Rings, that's what's interesting, because the characters never can truly experience joy because Tolkien was casting it as if it happens before the incarnation, right? They can have beauty and truth and goodness, but the gift of the joy is unavailable to them because they're not in proper relationship with God. So I'd say, you know, that Christianity is the religion of joy, and that is, if you understand that, you always stumble for the word because
yeah.
there's only one, right? You could say it's playfulness, it's appreciation, it's gratitude, it's, I mean, why Dante calls his work a comedy, because there's the happy ending in the marriage
yeah.
at the end.
Yeah, and the, you know, the love that moves the sun and the other stars.
Exactly.
Yeah. I just want to draw a couple of these threads together. One of the ways in which masterpieces are dismissed is, as I've said, as they're seen as exercises of, let's say, patriarchy, among other things. You've actually argued that, contrary to that notion of the West in particular as being a sort of patriarchal society, that in fact, at least in the form of Christendom, it was a matriarchal society. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I mean that ever since the marriage at Cana, when Mary comes to Jesus and says, they have no wine, and his first response to her is, you know, what is that to do with you and me, woman? And his second is to do what she said, and she says, do whatever he tells you, that Christianity recognizes the relationship between the sexes that is unique in human tradition, and that what we see in civilization in medieval Europe is a focus on pleasing the mother, quite, you know, sort of practically, materially, in things like her cathedrals, Notre Dame. You left out in your introduction of my three cheers, right, one of my most important points, which was chivalry.
Chivalry, yeah.
That is an idealization of a relation between the sexes, that the lady on the pedestal is served, right, but she also has to behave in a particular gracious way towards her servants, so you don't end up with women abusing men who are taking care of them properly. And to have the... I did a video symposium for several years with some of my friends, and we did some episodes on the question of the home and what the home is. And you say, mother is in the home. A mother's place is in the home. It's like, yes, because houses are built around mothers, and the Industrial Revolution is, in fact, an exercise in creating houses, right? All of the industries like, you know, the brick making and plumbing and glazing, and if you think about all of the great technological developments of the Industrial Revolution, it's to build houses so that people have, you know, places where they live. And that civilizational impulse is focused on having the mother in the place where is home. So I'd say that's Mary in her cathedrals.
So we've seen this recently, and you've written about the fire at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. So obviously there is this house built around and for a mother. Can you explain why the fire at Notre Dame had such a profound effect on Parisians and also everyone, not everyone, but lots of people in the West, certainly?
I think it's one of those things that's easy to take for granted. Everybody had taken Notre Dame for granted. It's just there in the center of the city, and it's the great tourist attraction, so everyone comes. And when it caught fire, it was interesting, the layers of responses, right? It was very encouraging, obviously, to see young people kneeling and saying the Ave Maria in the night when we were hoping that the roof wouldn't, that the vaults wouldn't collapse. In the subsequent responses, it was the, you know, the worry about what modern architecture would do with the renovation, and saying we do actually see Gothic architecture as a style that we don't want adulterated with these modern monstrosities. For myself, I mean, responding to it was saying that this was a building built at a time when the impulse was to make the most beautiful home you could for Our Lady. And what I responded to in my reflections on the fire was, if Christians should not despair at that fire, we should take it as the opportunity that medieval Christians did, which was to rebuild. Cathedrals, churches caught fire all the time in the Middle Ages, and the response was new life, right? New growth, to recognize the need to rebuild a new place of worship.
And so perhaps it was a catalyst for a very positive outpouring of feeling.
Yes.
For this monument, and for more than just the monument, for what it represents.
Yes.
Yeah. Rachel, one last question. We ask this of all our guests on the podcast. What is the book that has had the most profound influence on your life? You may have already mentioned
it. Already been talking about it, because it's The Lord of the Rings. And it's taken me a long time to understand why it had such a profound effect, because I did read it growing up. And in the course, the main theme that I try to get across for the students is this understanding of creativity. And, I mean, Tolkien's appreciation of what it meant to be made in the image and likeness of a maker, and therefore called by our making in the image and likeness of an artist to create great art ourselves, to, in his version, subcreate. And so there's the tension between that call to participate in the beauty of creation as against, and then the other pole of the story is obviously Sauron's desire to dominate all of the wills of the creatures, and that the great evil is both holding on to your creations possessively and trying to force other people to bow to your will. And realizing all of that, that, you know, so I recently was received into the Catholic Church. His faith was incredibly important to his own creativity, to his scholarship, and to his family life, that recognizing that that has been working on me all along in my life, to understand the sacramentality of being creatures and artists and free.
Rachel, thank you so much for this conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And we're so delighted to have you as our guest in Sydney. And I can't wait for your lecture this evening on great books of the Middle Ages and how to read them. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.